Now, that's why I'm dealing with a matter which I'll get the agenda changed accordingly. I've now got the revised Friday the 24th. I don't know if everyone does, but it shows it as the adoption of the report, DTI, SEZ, report, no, report back from DTI on that T. We can give T a little miss. Go later. Response from the Parliamentary Law Advisor to the DTI's response on the SEZ. We will do that, you know, as I see people giving a jaundiced look on the left. And then the IPAP. Now, it was also my intention to do this. I will not pursue this if we do not have the people who were involved for the last 5 months in this process. So, I want that just, let's keep that there and keep that in mind when we adopt this agenda. Propose the adoption of the agenda from someone and Honourable who? McIntosh, seconded by Honourable Van der Merwe. Right. Now we move on to a matter I asked us to just entertain early, and that is the report that we did earlier last night and we adopted in the main, but there were reservations on certain clauses. The Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, having considered the subject of the broad-based black economic empowerment, Honourable, the bill B42 2012, referred to it and classified by the joint tagging mechanism as the Section 76 bill, reports the bill with amendments, B42A 2012. The committee further reports that the Democratic Alliance, the Congress of the People, and the Freedom Front Plus objected to the amendments in Clause 1B, only as it relates to the definition of black, and to Clause 3 for not including. But not everyone objected to that third one here about the Employment Equity Act. It was only the Honourable Albert. Okay, so there was a support for that then, wasn't there? Subject to Section 3 of the Employment Equity Act. It may not have been your amendment, but you supported it. The following amendments were rejected. 1. Black people refers historically disadvantaged persons who, A, are citizens of the Republic of SA by birth or descent. I think you can read that there. B, became citizens of the Republic. Small Roman 1, Small Roman 2, and C, due to the apartheid policy that had been in place, did not have the franchise in national elections. Right? These were the amendments that were rejected. The second point, 2, to insert the following words after Act in Clause 3, subject to Section 3 of the 63 of the Employment Equity Act. Right. Are we all on the same page here? Do we all agree that is what was agreed to? Honourable Hill Lewis?
Chair, I think the definition in the bill is actually black person or black people. It's not just black.
I'm saying the actual move, though. Are you referring to the following amendments were rejected, black people?
No, in the paragraph that starts, the committee further reports that the DA, Pope,
yeah,
FF
right.
Plus objected to the amendments in Clause 1B only as it relates to the definition of black. I think that should read black people.
Correct. Can someone just confirm that for me? Yes. All right. Well, with that minor, correction there, more on the technical thing, it was overlooked. Is there then agreement as to what we did pass in terms of the report and what we did adopt with the reservations contained here, written here. Honourable Kwabasa?
Yes, I would yes, Chairperson, with the amendment that is not being effected now, it reflects what we did yesterday.
Right, thank you, Honourable Kwabasa. Honourable Sue Honourable Vandermeer.
Yeah, I may be wrong, but we rejected the Honourable Albert's amendments too. Mm. And if you are putting in full the amendments that we rejected from,
that's right.
Should we not also put in full the amendments proposed by Honourable Albert? Because I see he's got that 1, 2, 3 amendments actually. Four amendments.
Yeah,
I'm just asking as a
You see why I could be wrong, but I mean we've got a legal person here from Parliament, Advocate van der Merwe. But in fact, when he proposed, you know, he proposed his own amendment. The first two parts were not seconded. I mean,
I'll
be your point. So it didn't actually get through the first process.
I see, okay.
And on the other hand, Honourable McIntosh's wasn't either. Do you remember the one of his? One.
Okay.
And he actually said he conceded his and he supported the DA one. I'm just looking at yourself, Honourable McIntosh. So I gather that if we don't get to the second part of that process, we don't reflect on it. Am I correct, right, okay. Well, I'm only correct because I'm being advised here. Thank you. All right, members, this is important, and I know that our advocate from Parliament has had a quick look, although this wasn't really what she was dealing with, and you've checked it yourself. So I want to thank those who've now just done a final clean-up, and to be sure that it is this report that's going forth. Is this report going to be adopted, please? Can we have a proposer? The one you see in front of you with the slight technical amendment by the Honourable Hill Lewis. But this is now, we're just doing it again. Yes. No, it's we've done it technically last night, but just because normally this goes through on a telephonic process. With the chair. We're now doing it here. So do you agree then, Honourable Hill Lewis, that this is then in order with what you had contributed to?
Yeah, I just want to check one thing. The same paragraph I referred to earlier, grouping the two objections together, does that mean that we supported the second amendment, the Freedom Front Plus amendment? Because we, in fact, we did not.
I did raise this with the Secretary, that I thought that that was not what had been agreed to by the Right. So, just so everyone understands, this is normally a process conducted by the Chair with the relevant person, but this was a complicated process. So we will just write here that the first one, yes, and then the Freedom Front alone will be referred to as a second. And you will be sent this before it goes on the ATC, George.
Thank you.
Right. Can we move off on that then and go straight to the CES? We've got here a number of people from DTI, the DDG, Mr. Chukfupa, Mr. Ngaka, the Chief Director, Ms. Baiepi, Mr. Subinga, Director, Ms. Jonathan, Director, and Mr. Sertoli, a Deputy Director. Right, thank you very much. And our State Law Advisor, I don't see the State Law Advisor here, but I do see the Advocate van der Merwe here, the Parliamentary Legal Advisor. Yes.
The State Law Advisor is here, Chair, I think.
Oh, right. Okay, then I recognize. recognize them. Thank you, Mr. Chukwupa. Can you then lead us on this? Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, good morning, members of the committee, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to provide our comments on the public input that they made this week on the bill. In providing the response, we briefly looked in detail on the background by going through some of the aspects and chapters of the bill that were commented on this week, and then we'll try and go in detail on each of the different inputs that were made. As part of the background, Chair, the bill has followed all the normal and regular processes. It's been submitted to Parliament. It was gazetted for public comment. Sometime last month, Minister and the DG came, and actually when they presented the bill to the committee. In terms of getting into the bill itself, the bill seeks to establish an advisory board. The relevant thing maybe to think about in terms of the advisory board is that it comprises of 15 people, 9 of which are from government and different institutions such as the IDC and the Development Bank, and 6 of those people are not necessarily from government. 3 are independent experts, and 3 will be chosen from representatives of business, labor, and civil society. And these representatives will be required to have knowledge and experience relevant to the SEZ. And then members will be appointed for 2 consecutive terms. In terms of the framework, institutions that can apply for an SEZ include different levels of government and also public-private partnerships as defined by the Treasury regulations, and also any combination of the different levels of government and the private sector. Applications for designation, there is a criteria that is stipulated in the bill that would involve things like the feasibility, the area, the objectives, and so forth. And then the board would look at this, recommend to the minister, and if successful, the minister would designate and issue a license to the applicant. Upon the designation, the licensee then is required to establish a special economic zone board. And I think it's important when reading the bill to distinguish between the advisory board, which is the board that advises the minister, and the special economic zone board, which is the institution that is created by the licensee for the purpose of furthering the objectives of developing the SEZ. And the functions of the board obviously will be to develop the SEZ, to regularly provide reports to the minister, and more importantly, to appoint an entity to operate, develop, and manage the SEZ following a defined procurement process. If the SEZ fails to comply with the prescribed conditions, the Act provides the minister with the authority to appoint an administrator to take over the functions of the SEZ, obviously after negotiating or consulting rather than negotiating with the board. Minister may also suspend or withdraw designation of an SEZ which does not fulfill its requirements. And minister may redesignate an area as an SEZ where this designation has been previously withdrawn. The SEZ operator has to be appointed in terms of a fair and transparent process. And before they can begin with their sanctions, they need to obtain an operator permit from the minister. And the operator, there is a criteria that is stipulated that has to do with the capability of the operator. And one of the reasons why this clause is important is because we are concerned that we would want a capable institution developing the SEZ. For a business to be located in an SEZ, it would also need to apply and be approved by the minister. It would have to obviously be a business that meets the objectives of the SEZ, and minister will approve, obviously based on the recommendation of the board. The importance of this is that one of the things that we would like to prevent is relocation, because given the incentives that are going to be offered in the SEZ, there is a great temptation that businesses would want to relocate just for the purposes of the incentive, where there is no additional benefit to the country in terms of either technology, new jobs, and so forth. And we've tried to summarize in a diagram the framework as it exists. So maybe to recap over that, the applicant who would become the shareholder applies to the minister for designation. The minister then issues a license. The licensee then establishes the business entity or enterprise, which has something called an SEZ board that governs that. And the SEZ board then appoints an operator using a transparent process. Now I move to some of the issues that were raised this week. There was an issue that was raised regarding the definition of port of entry. We used a definition that came out of the Immigration Act. There was also an issue where especially the Chemicals Association questioned whether the bill actually does include the IDZ. We had previously, from the SEZ perspective, the port of entry really refers to the entry of goods, so the relevant descriptions would have to be something that is related to the Customs Act. And that's previously what we had agreed to at NetLab. Somehow in the process of taking through the process of the state law advisor, this was changed. And also the IDZ are part of the SEZ framework, and they are defined within the IDZ. There were quite a lot of comments that were raised with regard to the board, whether it should be advisory or rather it should be allowed to be given the power to make decisions. There was an issue as to whether it appears to be an executive board in nature. Some public representative questioned whether, you know, it's advisable to have a constituency-based representation. There was an issue as to whether it should not consist of more people from the private sector. And also the Richard Bay IDZ asked whether, you know, given the seniority of the people who are in the board, whether we would not have a problem of quorum. Our response would be really that the decisions that are going to be made in relation to the SEZ are far-reaching decisions. The decision of designation in itself comes with a commitment of substantial resources. It also has a huge impact on the communities in which the SEZ have to be designated. And we still think that it's appropriate that it should be, it's a decision that should not be left to officials or unaccountable representatives, but it should be something that is taken at the level of the minister. We the board is not intended to be an executive board in the sense of our understanding of an executive board would be a board that is comprised of full-time people that are employed in an institution. So it is our intention that this would not be an executive board. The board was actually designed and put together in such a way that it would bring people with different expertise, both within government and outside of government, so that they can advise the minister on decisions that have to be made. We do agree that, you know, in a way the board does call for representation, but even when the minister has to appoint people from the different constituencies, the act would require that the minister take into account the knowledge and experience of those people in relation to the matter that the SEZ advisory board would be dealing with. So it's not a purely constituency-based representation. The board's functions are regulatory in nature, and it's important, regulation is a function of government, so it's important that people who are skilled in this area from government, in fact, in the board, we also think that there could be useful contributions from people outside of government, and we've tried to achieve an appropriate balance in respect to skill sets that are required. We do think that it's important that the board comprise of senior members to ensure that we get people with the necessary knowledge, experience, and expertise relevant to the IDZ. Just maybe to make an example, the decisions that the minister would have to make in relation to designating would involve issues around infrastructure, around the availability of power, the availability of logistics, and so an opportunity of having people from those departments in the board would make sure that that decision is informed also by people sitting in those different sectors of government. But also having participation by people outside of the department but still within government would ensure that we promote coordination in government, because in order for the program to be successful, it requires that there should be good coordination around planning for infrastructure, around issues around immigration, around issues regarding customs. So we've tried to bring in all those different departments that have got the knowledge and the responsibility for these different areas within government. We do not think that the issue of a quorum is going to be a problem. The quorum has been set at 50% plus, not 55% or 75%. So it's a reasonable quota for a quorum. And also, in addition for that, the bill allows for alternates to be part of the board. And also, you know, board members can take advantages of technology. They do not always have to have a physical meeting. Resolutions could be also taken via electronic means through the internet and through modern technologies. There was an issue that was proposed regarding participation by the private sector as to whether we had made adequate provision for that. Our view is that we have made significant, you know, scope available for the private sector to participate. In fact, the private sector would be able to participate at all levels within the different structures that are foreseen in the bill. The private sector will be able to participate, one, in the advisory board. Minister could appoint people from the private sector. The private sector can participate as owners of SEZ as part of the PPP. They can participate as operators. One of the strengths of the private sector is managing these kinds of industrialized estates. So we've made provision for the private sector to manage this. And obviously, the private sector are going to be investors in the SEZ. I think one of the issues that was raised was that maybe the private sector should be allowed to own and manage. We don't think that the type of SEZ that you are thinking of, that would be practical. One would require quite a lot of public input for something like this in the form of infrastructure, especially infrastructure and substantial government resources. So, and also wherever these institutions are established or these zones are established, it's going to have an impact on the resources of the municipalities with relation to water, with relation to electricity and so forth. So we think the correct model is to have a PPP between the private sector and government. There was also an issue that was raised by BUSA and Richards Bay IDZ as to whether, you know, in terms of the treasury regulations, we can get unsolicited bids for SEZ. I think that the regulations do provide for how the unsolicited bids could be handled, but the way they provide for that is that, you know, there should be, if a bid like that is received, I think they provide for a feasibility, then a fair and open and transparent procurement process. And in fact, our PPP regulations have received worldwide acclaim and recognition. They've resulted in quite a number of very innovative projects such as the Gautrain and so forth. So we believe that, you know, the treasury regulations on PPPs is the way to go. They are quite flexible enough to allow us to have a properly regulated PPP with the private sector. There was also then a concern raised by the Richards Bay IDZ as to whether the bill confuses an asset, which is the geographic area, the SEZ, and an entity, the juristic person that controls that asset. It was submitted that it does not make sense why the shareholder of the zone, rather than the zone itself, should be the licensees. And it was said that duties that would normally fall on the legal entity fall on the shareholder. It's quite a technical argument. Our reading of the bill is that the minister would regulate the licensee in respect to his functions related to the SEZ. So if the applicant was a municipality and the minister had to regulate that municipality, it would not be regulating the municipality over its other functions, but only insofar as the SEZ is concerned. That is, insofar as it is a licensee of the department. So it would actually, in reality or in substance, be regulating the instrument or the institution that has been established to give sovereignty to the objectives of the license, which is the SEZ board. We do think, though, that we can amend by substituting licensee for board where it refers to regulation by the minister. We think that the bill as it is correct, but in order to make it clearer, if the clause was changed, then we would agree to that. There was an issue as to whether existing sites could be considered for designation. This was raised by the chemical sector, which indicated that there are quite a number of industrial areas in the country that could benefit substantially from designation. And they gave an example of an area like that in KZN. There was also an issue around whether minister should publish his intention to designate an area as an SEZ. I think the comment was made that in certain instances the public could improve on the plans of the minister with the inputs that they made if the minister was to publish for public comment before he designates. There was also Richard Bay raised an area a concern to say that maybe the bill should provide for the amendment to the designated area, that is maybe to change the boundaries of an existing SEZ. In terms of the current legislation or the bill as it's written, it does not preclude the application for designation by an existing site. So existing sites can apply provided that they meet the criteria for designation. The bill as it currently stands, it does not prohibit the minister from publishing his intention to designate for public comment. The minister could always do that under the current legislation, but we realize that under certain instances, people or applicants could challenge the minister if at all he decided to publish for public comment, you know, if it's not required by the bill. So we think it's good practice, and we would not object to an amendment to enable the minister to publish his intention to designate. In fact, as it is currently, when we do designate an IGZ, we do publish for comment. We also do not think that the bill as it stands would provide the minister from changing the bill, the existing designation. Minister could redesignate where we wanted to amend the borders of an existing IGZ, but we also think that it might be useful to provide for a much more quicker process for amending the borders of an IGZ within the bill. There was an issue raised as to whether existing to the effect that, you know, the existing IGZ own and operate zones. So within the current existing IGZ, you do not have a licensee and an operator. The licensee and the operator are the same people. It was suggested that the bill prevents this arrangement, and it is proposed that we should allow for this arrangement in the new bill. In our understanding or reading of the bill, this is not actually prohibited. It is possible that the operator and the licensee institution, or the institution created by the licensee, that the board could be both the owner and the operator, but it would have to meet the two criteria required for being a board and also for being an operator. So it would have to get the two permissions separately from the minister by following the required criteria. There was quite a lot of comments made on the incentives that are going to be provided. There were comments that were made regarding issues of labor flexibility as an incentive to attract investors. Our response would be really that it would be inadvisable to write down the details of the incentives in the law. Most of the incentives that we are thinking about have to do with income tax, and the appropriate place for those incentives would be to capture them in the Income Tax Act. And income tax is really the custodian of that act is National Treasury and SARS, and at the moment we are talking to both National Treasury and SARS regarding making the necessary amendment to the Income Tax Act. In certain instances where we've got grant-based incentives and we've got rules regarding those incentives, they include very detailed criteria which can be amended from time to time, and we think that providing separate guidelines in those instances would be appropriate rather than having that inside an act. And especially with regard to incentive, the issue of international comparison was raised. Chair, in terms of coming with this bill and also the new SEZ policy, the department undertook quite detailed benchmarking studies and visits to different SEZs. As late as last year, I think the minister visited Batam IDZ in SEZ in Indonesia. We visited SEZ in Taiwan, in Malaysia, in Mauritius, in Kenya. So the bill is quite informed regarding what is happening in different parts of the world. Even the incentives that we are coming up with have been informed by this benchmarking. And coming with what we can learn from international experience, one of these things that we've learned is that really there is nothing like an SEZ there's no one size fits all approach to SEZ. Different countries have adopted different models, different regulations based on the needs of those countries. For instance, one of the things that we learned in China was that really, when China embarked on establishing SEZ, China did not have a market economy. They did not have institutions of the market. There were no rules to guide the private sector in China. So the Chinese came with an SEZ as a way also of establishing a market economy. It was something that was an experimental thing suited to the China of 1978 and 1979. South Africa has, we've got a highly developed market economy with quite well-recognized rules. We rank number 53 in the World Bank's Index of Doing Business. So our challenges are quite different than the ones that are in China. We cannot just transplant what was in China and bring it here to South Africa. And also in terms of labor flexibility, the sweatshop model is something that is no longer being eagerly followed around the world. The World Bank has just done a report that was released about 2 years ago surveying different SEZs, and the thing really is that, you know, all over the world, those sweatshops are being dismantled, and I think we've also seen currently as a result of what happened in Bangladesh that, you know, that there's a consumer movement in developed countries that is, you know, consumers themselves are putting pressure for the dismantling of these sweatshops. It's also not possible that with our constitution it would be possible to do away with the rights that are provided in the constitution in terms of freedom of association and so forth.
Just on that aspect.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. What did you were looking for?
there was an issue regarding the bill as to whether it should specify mechanisms to streamline approval processes to reduce red tape. Well, one of the big things that we really do think that the SEZ program can contribute to is reducing red tape further regarding issues around immigration, regarding issues concerning environmental impact assessment, regarding, you know, coordination of infrastructure. But we do not think that how that the arrangement to reduce the red tape can actually be legislated in the bill. Issues of immigration are dealt with, you know, within the Immigration Act, and the custodian department is the Department of Home Affairs. So is it with, you know, customs and other matters. We've been doing a benchmarking exercise and looking at different models of how this could be done. And one of the things that we've come up with is that one could have one-stop shops that are located at each SEZ, having representatives of relevant government departments, and those representatives could be empowered to make decisions. There are different permutations that we are looking into, but we do not think that, you know, it would be possible and it would be constitutional to legislate on matters of immigration in this particular bill. It was proposed that the board and not the minister should approve businesses to be located in the SEZ. And the concern here was that we could have major delays because the minister may not have, you know, the minister has got lots of other responsibilities. He's the Minister of Trade and Industry and not really just the Minister of SEZ. The bill does not provide whether a business that no longer qualifies to locate in the SEZ must remain in the SEZ or be removed. This is a comment from Icelandan IDZ. Icelandan IDZ proposed that such a business should remain in the SEZ but should not receive any of the benefits associated to operating in the SEZ. We do not really agree with the proposal that the board should approve businesses. We do think that in certain instances it may be possible for the minister to delegate, but we think that the ultimate responsibility should stay with the minister. In the sense that, you know, in certain instances when we will have a big investor. Having worked on the Alcan investment that almost materialized in the Eastern Cape, I realized how it involves substantial government resources. You know, it involves substantial investments from Eskom, from Transnet, and so forth. And we think again that the amount of resources that have to be spend government resources would justify that minister must ultimately make this decision. And also the other reason is that minister must make sure that when these government resources are deployed, that it's really in compliance with the objectives of meeting the SEZ. I've already talked about the support measures. In fact, this is one issue that Treasury has raised quite a lot with us in our negotiations. They are concerned that, you know, the DTI should be an effective gatekeeper because being in an SEZ is going to entitle you to resources. In terms of whether, you know, a company that no longer meets the requirements of an SEZ should still be allowed to stay in the SEZ or should relocate. We think that, you know, this eventuality would be covered by a minister when he approves a company to operate in an SEZ. There would be standard conditions and non-standard conditions as appropriate in the sense that, you know, and they would provide as to what would happen if a business no longer met the objectives of the SEZ. Because something like this does happen in practice. Markets change, objectives of business change, and we would want to provide flexibility in cases like this. But we think it's important that companies are not just given carte blanche. If a company comes in and says that we are going to be exporting 70% and we make commitments of substantial public resources because of that, it cannot be just allowed to walk from that commitment without, you know, there being consequences. Some of the things that we could renegotiate in those consensus would be imposing relevant but appropriate obligations at that time. There was an issue raised that we should provide for specific transitional arrangements, taking into account each individual IDZ's developmental path. The bill does provide for very flexible and wide-ranging transitional arrangements. It gives the current IDZ up to 5 years to meet the requirements of the SEZ bill, during which time I think they would still be considered SEZ, and we think that it's appropriate. It would not really be appropriate to draft specific transitional arrangements for each SEZ. There was an issue regarding guidelines that they should be published for public comment and must be binding on the DTI. The bill provides, there's obviously legislation, there is going to be regulations that are going to be published for public comment and that are going to be binding on the department. Guidelines, in our view, are really not subordinate legislation. What we are thinking of in terms of guidelines would be things such as, you know, for a feasibility study, we'd be saying to companies, in your feasibility study, we would want you to look at, for instance, infrastructure, and this is how we would want it addressed in the feasibility study. We do not think that something of that nature, it's really secondary legislation, and it's something that is subject to change over time. It should not really be something that is binding or that is legislative in nature. I've already spoken about the impact that the bill would have on ministerial functions. We do think that it could be reasonable still that we empower within the bill for minister to delegate certain specified functions. Also, maybe also for the board to delegate certain functions to subcommittees. But we do want to say, Chair, that with the 12I legislation, Minister approves each and every company that we provide incentives to, and within that legislation, our turnaround time for applications has been less than 45 days. So we think that this is something, even with our delegation, that our minister would be quite capable of coping with. And that is just, thank you.
You know, GDG, Mr. Chukwupa, I think it's a very comprehensive response to us, but the fact that we don't immediately interrogate should not give you the idea we're letting you off the hook. But I need your indulgence for a minute. You may have seen that we've got two people, in fact three people ill, if we consider the Oriani, Honourable Oriani Ambrosini. And we've managed to persuade an Honourable Member of the DA just to join us there. Thank you very much. It's not good, this is just an important process, and I know others have to leave for other meetings. Now, members, I said to one of the members here that this particular piece of legislation, the colloquium, the IPAP, the public hearings, we wouldn't like it to become stale. We want it to remain relevant. We're familiar with it. We've had this report now for several weeks. There are changes you requested to it, meaning we didn't want to create a PRO document for bulletin. You know, it had to be incorporated into the whole thing. And secondly, we said that as there was no report after the public hearings, it has to be merged into one. And you see that then under process, which simply tabulates this as we move along. I'm sure you can see that. When we saw people, what, page 2, page 3. the economic context remains the same. Right? Page 3. The fourth. Here you begin again to get bulletin factored in on page 4. And that we had to indicate that they, although they never got the tariff, they got the special contract. Did you see that there? So that's factored in and taken there. And on page 5, under beneficiation, which is what they did seem to be doing quite well, they are reflected there again, but so are others that you were in previous reports. The 4 is exactly the same, number 4 on page 5. The electricity tariffs remain the same. The Department of Trade and Industry on page 6 remains the same as previous. Page 7, all of those, there were no changes that I'm aware of on this page, and I have studied this. There was one little typo, a spelling mistake, I understand. And then on page 8, we did have to check on the SOLGA issue that was raised, where it was conceded. It wasn't just SOLGA. There were some separate municipalities that seemed to come in their own right, apart from being members of SOLGA. We dealt with that earlier. Page 8, the National Cleaner Production Centre. And then on page 9, yes, as with all of them, we have some smaller, hardly a PRO of 2.5 pages on bulletin, but simply a reflection of the core issues that we raised. But they are no different. We have removed all of what I call the PRO buff. And then we go to page 8. 10, rather, 10. You will see the beneficiation. The critical paragraph that we all added was that they said they've got this fantastic training institute, and just before 4.1.8, that paragraph, you will recall we spoke about them sharing that opportunity with others in the sector, that training opportunity, and we added that. Then you have the proposals there from DTI, which are the same as before, and you have page 10 at the end. Of course, 4.2, one of the great, I think, successes of this committee was to persuade Transnet to totally restructure these port tariffs in favour of manufacturing. And that was a great success for all of us. And certainly on the Eskom one, Honourable Hill Lewis, you managed to enable us to look at those models more critically that they had earlier given us. So the port, the review on the Eskom, the massive changes on the port tariffs, and then on page 12 again, we have the Transnet beneficiation. It hadn't yet quite kicked in, but it's coming, and then the conclusion. In the conclusion, there are no changes, as you can see. The earlier change had been to ensure that NEDLAC had been captured, and it is on 5.5. We then reviewed the way we did the acknowledgements as requested. We've only ever thanked our own staff per se here and not decided to throw in half the department when in fact we've acknowledged the department earlier on in the report. Is that quite clear? Right. Now, this report has not changed other than what you requested. But I now put it to you, I think the main thing is to look at your conclusion and your recommendations in this regard. Is your recommendation, do you still stand by it? Over to you for a brief comment. Right.
We have some. I propose the adoption.
Well, that's just jumping the gun. I haven't even put it to you. But I do understand you want to move off to your farm. But
no,
do we have someone? Honourable McIntosh, we accept your proposal for adoption. Can we have a seconder? Yes, Honourable Khadebe.
Before I got that, the only issue of acknowledge is I understand that the woman didn't take the department because the department is part of the family.
No, not furniture,
no, ash. But what is critical, on the issue of the acknowledgement, I think that it should be good that we acknowledge the minister in from the German embassy, because I think that it was extraordinary. Yeah, please, on the acknowledgement, because I think that he went out of his own way, moved from Pretoria, in particular, to come and get with us here.
We actually had two embassies. One was Ford, which was the American, the General, I don't know, General Motors or something. All right. Now, we can acknowledge them, but then, as I say, I don't want this to turn into a huge sort of thing. I'd like to keep to all protocol observed, but what we can do, if I can suggest, is to say we appreciate the cooperation from DTI, leave it like that, and also we appreciate that the industrial or what do they call these people, the trade, it's not trade, it is on the manufacturing, on the manufacturing side, the embassy, it's not the embassy, people from the embassy.
Normally a trade attaché or
he is a minister, but it's a minister in the sense of being in the ministry, the way we call them, ministers of trade. You follow? So I would ask...
Diplomat.
No, he's not. So, Andre, just get that. We will acknowledge them, all right? But as I say, there were the two of them. There was the Ford, and then there was the other one. And it they're not stakeholders, but we could call them overseas stakeholders and not put it as an acknowledgement, but in the stakeholders. You see? I don't want to find that we've crossed the line in terms of the diplomatic protocols. Do you follow? So I would rather just indicate it where we also received an input from X and Y. And in the acknowledgements, we simply thank DTI for their cooperation. Right? Can we? We've now had a proposer, Honourable Khadebe. Oh, thank you, thank you. And thank you. Right. Honourable Hill Lewis, thank you very much for saying, and thank you to your colleague here. I'm sure she is remaining with us. Is it the Honourable Schaefer? Thank you. Okay. And I would like to thank Mr. Chipfupa, the DDG of one of the DDGs of Trade and Industry, for actually assisting us, industrial development, you know, in this area. Thank you very much. We do appreciate that. Members, we've adopted this report finally. You'll get it checked and add the other bit. Fine. And we now move back. We have just heard the presentation by DTI, their response to what has come out already. Now, there are two ways we can do this. I can suggest that we get the responses first from our parliamentary people, and then we raise issues, because we may find that the issues are clarified one way or the other. We've had the DTI's response. And why don't we go that particular route, etc. So what we've got then here, I know that you would have had tea, but I think members are anxious for us to move on. And that is the response from the Parliamentary Law Advisor to the DTI's response on the submissions received. Advocate Charmaine van der Merwe.
Thank you.
Advocate is ready, you can just fire on.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. We had a very short time with this bill to actually, you know, consider the public comment and from there give something to the members. So I have not had a chance to discuss with trade and industry. I have not had a chance to discuss with the state law advisor. So what I'm giving you here is simply from the public comments what I am concerned about or not concerned about. It's a lot of pages, but I can quickly summarize. My biggest concerns relate to the role and relationship between the licensee, the SEZ as an entity, the SEZ board, and the operator. That for me is not clearly enough described. And I think DTI has indicated that there is some mismatch on the licensee especially.
Excuse me, I just want to get clear. Are you representing the LSO or the LS?
Honourable Martin, can you vote for the chair, please?
But there is no chair.
No, yes, there is.
Oh, I see. You're like Bismarck, where I sit in the chair. Okay, sorry. Mr. Chairman, I know. The presenter comes from the parliamentary office, but what is the parliament? The CLSO or the LS?
Chairperson, the office is called the Constitutional and Legal Services Office, and my title is Senior Parliamentary Legal Advisor. So the abbreviation CLSO is simply to indicate that comment originates from the office of the Parliamentary Legal Advisory Section.
Okay. And you're their spokesman.
I am their spokesperson for this bill. So my second concern is in respect of the members of the board. It's not a serious concern, but it does relate to the impact in practice of the ex officio appointments, the reappointments of those people, and there was a comment made on the removal of the full board. Now, removal of the full board has become something that in legislation is provided for in case the board is not functioning properly. So I think that is something that we need to look at. The third thing, and this for me is almost one of the two important things. The first thing is the roles that must be clarified. This thing for me is very important, is consultation. I think the bill does not make sufficient provision for consultation prior to designation, prior to suspension or withdrawal of designation, and prior to withdrawal of the operator permit. I think their consultation we need to make provision for. And then the interim arrangements, I hear that the DGI is of the opinion that the interim arrangements are clear enough, but I think we need to understand exactly what it is that the DGI envisage should happen with the current IDZs, and once we understand that, then we can see whether it is in fact making clear enough provision, because for me it is a little bit of a grey area. Now, it's a big document that you have in front of you. The full document that had all the public submissions summarised was 82 pages. It is now 38. The ones that I've deleted dealt with policy. So a lot of the public submissions were simply policy matters. which DGI will have to answer to. I'm not going to tell you every time, oh, this is policy, this is policy. And then there's also not, like I've now said to you, there are those four things that I think are important in respect of the bill that we need to look at. So I'll go very quickly through things that I think there is actually no problem with. On page one of your document, and I'll sort of go on the screen as I'm going through the document, just in case a member wants to follow on the screen. On page one, and going over onto page two, there's a concern about the assortment and complementary government support and enablement programs. I'm of the opinion there's no problem there. There's nothing in the bill that prohibits an SEZ from applying for different government funding. It simply is a framework for what the DGI will be providing. Over on page two, if we go to page two, there are actually two, and it goes over on page three, so I'll just say this is a repeat. There's a request that the SEZs must be almost separated from South Africa. Now, I understand where the argument is coming from. We want to create something special, but you can't separate them from the laws of South Africa. We will be creating a criminal-free zone because we'll suddenly have a zone where, not a criminal-free zone, a crime, a criminal-attracting zone is what I actually want to say. Because if you remove them from the laws of South Africa, you need to make separate laws for them. So all our laws here fall away. So I don't think that is what they mean. I think it may be a very broad statement that they have put out there, which I think is a bit, sure, you know, if we have to take them literally, it's really broad. I think what they mean is that they want specific laws, exemptions made in respect of specific laws of South Africa that will apply to that zone. It's not an offshore company. We cannot have that. That is not, that must, we get that out of our minds. It cannot be. So when we look at exemptions, yes, I think there everyone agrees there needs to be exemptions for SEZs. However, the question is, can it be done in this bill? Now, first of all, if we exempt from labour laws, the question to the DGI is, have you consulted with the Department of Labour? And what do they say about this? If we talk about income tax, the question again, have you consulted with SASH, with Treasury? What is their take on this? Should it be in this bill? Should it not be in the labour bill? Should it not be in the income tax bill? So I'm of the opinion this is not the place for it. I don't think it's something that we need to consider right now. It is going to become an oversight issue. This committee will have to start asking, so what are you doing to make SEZs successful? Who are you talking to? Where are those amendments to other legislation? What is happening? But it's not for this bill. The next issue, the second last row on page 2, deals with property rights and being able to securely and freely trade. There's nothing in the bill that prohibits that, so I don't know where that concern comes from. Over on page 3, that first row there just deals again with the offshore SEZ idea, which is just not going to work. In respect of...
Madam Chair, I'm just concerned that... I think the department...
Well, you can't because your mic isn't even on because I never recognised you.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't want to delay and I know there will be questions afterwards, but I do think we need to be and get on the same page on what they used in offshore because I think the Honourable Legal Advisor is interpreting offshore in quite a radical way, which I've introduced the evidence wasn't suggesting, although it is a special economic zone in that sense. And I think they were just using offshore as an analogy to get through the idea that you create an economic zone which is very special and peculiar in that sense and not necessarily exactly the same arrangements. So, I don't want us to, I think, mentally to fixate on this word offshore. In other words, we're not sending them off to St. Helena Island under their laws and none of our laws.
No, I think when people start talk economics, they know darn well what offshore means. It means off our shores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Honourable Magistrates. That is not my intention at all. But when we deal with bills, we need to be very careful about the words that we use. So unfortunately, I think that when the submission was made, they might have tried to overemphasize something. And from a legal point of view, I need to advise the committee that it's a problem if we go with that overemphasis. It is simply a question of whether this bill can, in fact, and as I've explained, I think what was meant was that they want exemptions from certain laws. And so that is what, when they say offshore, that's what they meant. But even for that, I think this bill is not the appropriate place right now. It might be in future, not right now, unless DGI can confirm to this committee that they have consulted with the relevant department. So if I may continue then on page 3, the first column there simply deals with the same issue. The second second row deals with dispute resolution. I'm of the opinion that is something that can be done in an agreement. Once we have sorted those roles and relationships out, we won't have a problem in respect of dispute resolution and how it will work with how will the SEZ and the SEZ board and the licensee and the operator and the enterprises, if our roles are clearly defined. And that was one of the aspects I've identified as something that I am concerned about. In respect of the policies and attitudes of the Minister for alignment with the National Development Plan, I said that is a matter that this committee can note as something for oversight. It's not for the bill. It is something where the department will have to come and tell this committee what are they doing in respect of that. The same with labour structures. That is something that either the department must do and come back to this committee, or if the committee wants to play a more active role, the committee can say, well, look, we would like to sit with the portfolio committee on labour and discuss how we're going to do this, but it's not for this bill. Then in respect, if we turn over to page 4, we're dealing with a number of definitions. I don't think, just to save time, I'm not going to go through each of them, but on page 4 specifically, I have no concerns with those definitions. They are clear. They are used consistently in the bill. I don't think that there is a problem. If we go to page 5, the first aspect, the first row there, deals with the minister being, am I not on the right page? I just want to say that I'm on the screen on the right page as well. Yes. The first definition there is the minister responsible. I disagree. I think it's clear as it is. When it comes to whether a licensee and an operator, again, that speaks to roles. The second row there, it speaks to roles. If we fix that, then we don't have a problem in the definition. In respect of persons, the definition for persons, I do agree that we have a problem. Person in the definition includes a trust and a foundation. But in clauses 7, 9, 10, 13, 14, and 16, we use the word person with reference to a natural person because that relates to the board and persons that are members of the board. That can't be a trust or a foundation. So we need to just relook at that definition and make sure that it's quite clear that we say person in relation to an operator or in relation to these clauses or however, but that needs to be corrected. Port of entry as well, I agree there's a concern if it only relates to persons. I can't think of a port that will not deal with persons, but for the purposes of this bill, it is probably something that would be advisable to correct. If we go to page 6, the first row there, that is such a minor thing. I do agree we can make it read a lot better, but also I'm of the opinion it's scheduled to an act and not of an act, so that's just a tiny amendment that I will propose to what was proposed by Richards by IDZ, but it would be nice if we can just fix that definition so that it reads and conforms with how other acts would refer to another, how other bills or acts would refer to other acts. In respect of directors versus board members, I've actually gone to have a look at what the Companies Act says about directors. It's clearly defined in the Companies Act, which to me means that in relation to the Companies Act, director is given a specific meaning. It doesn't mean the same necessarily outside of that act. So I went to have a look at Oxford Dictionary. Oxford Dictionary says a director is a person who is in charge of an activity, department, or organization. So in fact, the word fits. That's exactly what it means. But that is not a crucial aspect. If members feel, look, let's rather make it members of the board, that is something that can be done. But at this point in time, it is in order. There is a legal definition, not a legal definition. There is a normal usage definition that does comply with that. In respect of support measures and including in relation to who the support measures must be, in the next row. I don't think it is necessary. We're all dealing with this act. We know what this act in the end will deal with. But if we can make it clearer, then that is also not there's nothing wrong with making it clearer and adding. However, I would not use the words that were used proposed by Richard by IDZ. I would rather say it should be the specific role players identified in the bill. Your licensee, enterprise, your operator, and so on. The next row deals with language between clauses 2F and 37. Wait, I'm doing something wrong there, sorry. I pressed the wrong button there. Between 2F and 34K. Now, I've given you the wording of those two clauses, and you can clearly see that the one speaks about facilitate and the other one speaks about establishment. So I do think we need to just align those two clauses so that your object of the bill in fact is aligned with the content of the bill. In respect of the targeted treatment of companies and so on, this is something that is not for the bill to really do. The bill sets up a framework. So when we talk about strategy, policy, implementation, that is something that will flow from the bill and will become a matter for oversight. The last row on that page deals with the list. And they say we should make provision for all the purposes that an IDZ might have. And I'm saying no. The clause clearly says includes. It means it's not an exhaustive list. It means it can have other things. There's no need for anything to be amended there. If we go over to page 8, the first row there deals with policy making. And the fact that is a constitutional authority that is given. What I'm saying is I disagree with the argument. What this clause is trying to say is that when the minister makes policy, he must consult with the board, with the advisory board. So that is what this clause is about. It's not about the fact that it's giving him authority to make policy. It's about that consultation. So I disagree that there's any need to be amended. The next deals with the constituency-based representation of the board. Now, the board is not an executive board. I do not understand where that thinking even came from. It's in its title, advisory board. The fact that it makes decisions, the fact that it votes, the fact that it makes resolutions is simply within its own process. Those decisions and resolutions have no impact on the outside world. But a committee must be able to get finalization. How else do you make a recommendation if you can't make a decision on the recommendation to make? So it's not executive, it's advisory in nature. And as I read the bill, it is quite clear that DDI is trying to create cooperative governance. They're not getting that support directly when they go, so they're saying we're going to bring you to us. So we want these departments on a board. You will come with the hat of your department. You don't come as a individual. You come as ESCOM. You come as transport, and that is where you will sit. And you will present that department and that mandate, and you will tell us what that department is going to do for SEZ. So I disagree with that that argument. If we go to page 9, and this is where one of my concerns is about the ex officio appointment. Reappointment of that is not going to be possible. So we need to just make a distinction between ex officio members and members that are appointed by through nomination process. Your reappointment there will have to be different. So there I definitely think we need to do something. The last row there, it again still speaks to representative designation. What we have here is a DG that will be appointed. I'm not sure how we want another, how we want to say a representative, but the bill already says who will be the representative. And that department and that entity will have to agree. And I've asked DTI to confirm to me whether there was consultation. I did get that confirmation from DTI, and I can confirm it to the committee as well. It is not as if these entities were placed in this bill and it's a surprise to them. They know that this is coming, and they could have voiced their concerns, and nothing has been done. So next, page 10. Although this is a policy matter, the fact that we have Director General versus DGGs, I need to just point out and make the members aware, I am a bit concerned. It is very high level. I think members of this committee will already know how difficult it is to get members at a very high level to come to meetings. So it is a concern. It's a policy decision. Nothing legal. There's nothing stopping the DG from being on this board. But the committee might want to interrogate, and DGI might want to say, what are they going to do to get the DGs there so that this board can actually function. The next row on page 10 deals with the public nominees to be renominated and the issue of consecutive terms versus two terms. Now, renomination of the private representative. If there is good corporate governance, which there must be, then your board will have a public, performance review done on members. Now, the minister will reappoint, and I think we must maybe make it clear that the minister may reappoint, rather than, there is a reappointment process, to give some discretion to the minister, so that if a member is not performing, he or she is not reappointed. That's it. So I would suggest that we perhaps look at giving the minister the discretion to reappoint, and then the consecutive, that's quite easy to amend. And it might be good to make it very clear whether we are talking about two consecutive terms or two terms period, whether there's a gap of 5 years in between or not. I think that is something that the committee must consider. Making the term of office subject to the clauses dealing with disqualification and vacation of office is actually superfluous. It's not necessary. They are both there in the bill. It's quite clear that if you don't qualify, you can't be a member. It's as simple as that. But if the committee wants to make it more clear, it's very easy to insert that in the bill. If we go to page 11, on the first row, there is something there that deals with conflict of interest. I will deal with that in the next page. Apologies, because it was done quite fast, I think I skipped that comment there, or my line might not have been right or whatever, but I will deal with conflict of interest. In respect of organs of state should be able to substitute, replace, or end periods, the nominee is the DG. I don't know who else they want to nominate but the DG. It doesn't make sense. There's one DG for a department. Most departments, I think, have one DG. I think there's one or two that have two. So maybe there you can argue about that. But surely that will happen in consultation anyway. There's no need for us to actually provide for that in the bill. I would be amazed if the board members aren't communicating with DGI. So it's not necessary to go to that level. Saying it here. Then a board member also vacates office. No, they don't vacate office. Their membership ends. It's not an office that we're creating. DTI has used the words vacating an office, and in fact, that is the next comment to say ceasing to hold office. It's very technical, but we can look at that. If it reads easier on the eye to say ceasing to hold, then let's do that. It means more or less the same thing. On this regard, DTI has pointed out to me, but the rest of the bill speaks about vacating office. So, we might want to just keep it the same. So, if we go to the next page, page 12, the removal of the board, I think that is maybe important that we do consider a provision that provides if the whole board is not functioning. This is what the minister can do. There can be an interim board until a new board has been established. That would be just prudent to put in. a conflict of interest. Now, a conflict of interest is quite simple. If this committee is considering something where one of the members have a personal interest, that member excuses himself from that meeting. It happens in every committee. Now, if that issue in the SEZ advisory board continues for 3-4 months, then the minister must say, but it's no longer in the public interest that you are part of this board. I need to remove you as a member. So there's no concern about public interest. I think that corporate governance provides sufficiently for that. The next row deals with the board being able to enter into partnerships. Clause 11.2b, I'm of the opinion, makes sufficient provision for that. A decision-making or an executive role. As I've explained before, we need to just make a clear distinction between a decision that has an impact outside of the board and a decision made inside the board. The board is advisory. Their decisions inside is to make a recommendation to the minister, who will then act. So I don't think that for me seems to be where this is going with the board. The last row on page 12, dealing with fidelity, honesty, integrity, clause 13 provides for a code of conduct. This kind of wording must go into that code of conduct, and that is something that the minister will approve. It is something, of course, there's no legal impediment in inserting that into the bill, but in my opinion, it's already provided for by making provision for a code. If we go to page 13, there's a recommendation that the concepts of partner and business associate must be defined. It's only used in this clause. It is a term that is actually well known. It's not used in another term here, but there would be no impediment if we want to include that. Perhaps specifically the business associate, because it goes quite far, it includes an employer. So if the committee decides that, look, it is this broad, then perhaps we will have to interrogate the definition and make sure that it is in fact what we want it to be. The last comment on that page 13, relating to minutes and the fact that your recording of the meeting must be in the bill, no, that's a corporate governance issue. Meetings must be minuted, it must be recorded. Otherwise, you will fall foul of King 3. So there's no need for that to be included in a bill. It speaks for itself. If we go to page 14, again, it speaks here about the removal of the full board. I agree with that. Underneath that, the robust and predictable funding dispensation that is required, I think that will be addressed in regulations. It's very... if you think about the environment under which incentives are created, they are targeted periodically at certain aspects. This year we target A because we want to achieve something. Next year we see, oh, we're not going to achieve A, so we need to do something else. Then you change your incentive. Or you say, wow, we've achieved A within 6 months, and our target now is actually alongside E, and we need something different. You need flexibility for that, and that is where your regulations come in. So to have something like that in a bill, I think will actually restrict, because this is, it's very operational, your incentives. It targets specific aspects, right. And so it's much better suited in regulations, and I think it will be perfectly addressed there. If we go to page 15, that first one, apologies, that should have been deleted. It's simply a comment. The second row there speaks about the different incentives to be determined, and like I'm saying, the bill is setting up a framework. This will be dealt with in the regulations. The same about green and brown fields. It will depend on what DTI is targeting, whether they will allow green and or brown fields. So that will be provided for in your regulations. If we go to the next page 16, the access to resources, allowing municipalities to apply for a license. The fact that this may compromise service delivery to your outside of the SEZ, I very much disagree with this statement, because your municipality will be like any other applicants. That municipality will have to prove to the minister that they can run this SEZ in alongside the if a municipality comes and says, look, we only actually have funds to put electricity in our residences, not really for industrial, but we want this industrial park, PDI minister must say, I cannot give you this SEZ. Where will you get your funding from? So I think there's sufficient provision made for the requirements for an applicant, what an applicant must prove, and I don't see why we should discriminate against municipalities. It doesn't make sense to me. Then the next comment saying only one sphere of government can apply, no. The clause is clear. They can acting alone or jointly. So clearly more than one can do. In respect of private entities, I think DTI has already addressed why they would rather prefer private public partnerships than private entities. If we go to page 17, the private sector plans for investment not being taken into account when designation is done. Now, here is my second big concern, consultation. I do believe consultation is very important before designation. So if there is a publication in the Government Gazette beforehand and public submissions are drawn, I think it will resolve a lot of potential problems that might come from designation. So definitely I agree, not so much in the sense of the private sector plans, but consultation. There must be consultation. If we go to page 18, there we are talking about, am I right? Yes, 18. Existing specific locations to expand. Now, this for me is a policy matter. If DTI would like expansion, then I think we must make it very clear in the bill. I'm not sure whether that is, in fact, the policy or the policy direction that they would like to go in, but I agree that it must be done. The next row, duplication of clauses 226A and 23.1, absolutely. We need to delete one of the two. We need to decide in which clause it must be and then decide on that. That is where it must go. In respect of expansion and non-contiguous, again, it's a policy matter. DTI must explain to this committee what their policy is on expansion of an IDZ, whether the land mass must be one, whether there could be corridors of non-SEZ in between, what do they envisage, what is the practical implications of this, and then I think we must just make it very clear in the bill, if that is allowed, that it is in fact allowed. That, I think, will also just be assisting DTI when they do start having applications, not to have to start with interpretation of the Act, but rather have it clearly stipulated if that is the case. Now, the next page, page 19, I want to show the committee something. When you have a look at what is currently, and I apologize, I totally forgot to make copies of this. I will send it on to Andre so that you can have it. What you have there is a national government, provincial government, municipality, public entity, or public-private partnership can apply to the minister to be designated. They must show resources, feasibility, ownership. The board considers the application, recommends to the minister. Minister designates and issues a license. Then you will see up there your national government, provincial government, municipality, public entity actually becomes a licensee. Okay. So as long as you understand licensee, then I go to the more important slide, slide 2. Now we have, let me just see if I can get that thingy away. There. Now we have our licensee. That's the first entity that we have in this bill. The licensee must establish the area, the special economic zone, as a national or provincial government business enterprise, municipal entity, or a company. There's your second entity. Then they must also appoint a SEZ board. There's your third entity. They must appoint an operator, fourth entity. And if you look at the circles that I've drawn, it seems that all of them are doing the same thing. We've got the SEZ board here that manages the business and affairs of the SEZ. The operator manages the SEZ on behalf of the licensee, and the licensee develops the strategic plan, the business plan, financial plan, records, financial. So it's clear there is something not right. And in fact, DTI has confirmed that it seems that there might have been a copy-paste error where the word licensee was inserted where it shouldn't have been. So whether that was the case or whatever, we need to fix that.
Yeah.
So I thought to just draw that schematic, because when I started going through it and I listened to the public comments, I thought, I'm confused. So I thought I'll put it there, then members can clearly see there is something that we need to fix. maybe not serious, it can be small changes in the bill, but we need to fix it. So if we go then, on page 19, the last row there, it again deals with these the confusion of roles. So I'm not going to readdress that. On page 20, there we deal with the fact that what they say here is that Treasury requires for a government business enterprise to be a company. Now, 3 years ago, that was not a requirement. So 3 years from now, there might be a different requirement. So what I'm saying is, no, let's simply say you must, what we can do is because it's not the licensee that will establish. It will be Treasury that establish. So the licensee must apply for this to be established. Let's just make the work of the licensee a little bit easier. But that application should simply be, I'm applying for a national or a provincial government business entity. Whatever Treasury requires from me as the licensee, I must do that. So if Treasury says you need to form a company in terms of the Companies Act, then I as licensee must do that. It's not necessary for the bill to tell me to do that. Because 3 years from now, we might have to come back and simply amend this one clause for the new requirements that Treasury has. So the only thing there is to say apply rather than actually set it up. On page 21, that again deals with the roles. Page 22 again deals with the roles of the number of entities that we have, so I'm not going to go into that again. The last row there talks about, in fact, let me read to you the way Margot summarized it for us. If the proposed arrangements are found to be constitutionally practicable, the passage of the SEZ bill could have implications in regard to effective project command and oversight of economic zones. I could not find a constitutional issue in the comments. So, unfortunately, 22, I'm now on 22. 20 and 21 dealt with roles, so I just quickly went through them. So page 22, I could not find a constitutional issue. It would be nice if they could have rather given us the issue, then I could have looked at it. I cannot find a constitutional concern. And unfortunately, what I have found is that people often say, oh, there's a constitutional concern. And when you start asking what, then it sort of peters out into nothing. So I think, you know, I couldn't find anything. There's one proposal that I have a constitutional concern with, and I will point that out to members. Otherwise, I could not find any constitutional concern with this bill. In fact, also the state law advisor who is present had to certify that the bill has no constitutional concern. So I think this committee has from two sources, there's no constitutional concern with this bill that we have seen. I understand that there might be a difference of opinion, but you also know that the more lawyers you have, the more opinions you have. But currently, at least we have two. yes. Because we have to also acknowledge the point of the other side. We might be, you know, next meeting we might be colleagues and not an opposing side. So we also have to strategize sometimes.
It's important to declare more than one bill unconstitutional that has been certified by state
laws. No, that is absolutely correct. I mean, from Parliament's side, that is why parliamentary legal advisers are also sitting in committees. It's not to say that we are infallible. And unfortunately, I mean, even constitutional court decisions, I think almost not one of them, I think there were two or three out of a list of 90 that we've recently checked that had a single voice. The rest had dissenting judgments. So, you know, if the constitutional court judges can't agree, you know, humble me. Where must I fit into the picture? So, it is unfortunately the case, but it is at least the Parliament is providing that assistance to the committee to have a second pair of eyes and another voice that can warn. If on page 23, the last there, the concern was that the Auditor General must audit these SEZ books. Now, I went to look at the Public Audit Act and Section 41F states, as well as the preamble, that the Auditor General, as the external auditor, is established as national and provincial for all. Is established as the external auditor of national, provincial, state departments, municipalities, and any other institutions or accounting entities required by national or provincial legislation to be audited by the Auditor General. It is thus within the mandate of the Auditor General for this bill to provide for the AG to audit. Whether that is what should be the case is a policy decision. And that is, the committee can comment, you know, can interrogate that, whether it should go to the Auditor General. But that, it is absolutely possible. It is, there's no legal concern with that. If we go to page 24, here I'm again simply going to go quite fast through this, because this is actually simply roles. What I do want to highlight, though, is that because our roles aren't clearly identified, and I know DGI has said, but you know, taking over the licensee's role will simply be in respect of the SEZ, but that's not how the bill reads at the moment. It can be interpreted very broadly. In practice, it will not be applied that way. I think we can all see that it won't be applied that way. But we need to be careful, because a constitutional challenge could be on something that will never happen in practice, but simply on the way that it's worded. So I would rather prefer we get the role sorted out, we make it very clear that when something is taken over, it is not the licensee. In fact, I would recommend to the committee, but that when we come to deliberations, my recommendation would be that the role of the licensee be actually very limited. Limited to setting up the SEZ company or government business enterprise and appointing the board. And that's it. From there, the board runs, appoints the operator, runs the SEZ, because then if something is taken over, it is that board that's taken over, and it makes perfect sense. So, but that is something that we can look at deliberation when we look at the roles of these four entities. The next row on page 24 deals with consultation. And like I said before, I think it's extremely important. Every party that might be affected by a decision should be consulted. When we're looking at the withdrawal or suspension, I think it's very important that every party that might be affected should be consulted. Then in respect of the last row there, saying that the word substantially should be included before the words fail to comply. Now what this clause deals with is failing to comply with specific conditions that are placed on each category of SEZ. And I'm saying I disagree with this proposal, because if there's a condition on the SEZ to have a certain capability and you don't comply in 1% measure, you don't comply with that condition. It's not about, we're not talking here about whether you have your curtains halfway closed and there's this tiny gap and therefore you substantially comply. That's not what we're talking about here. We are talking about an SEZ must have a perimeter fence. If there's 1 centimeter gap, you don't have a perimeter fence, you're not complying with security measures. So I absolutely disagree with substantially. And in any event, if the minister is unfair and that centimeter is actually a gate that was to be put in that afternoon, then that decision can be taken on review. So, you know, there's no remedy. But I think we must be very clear, if there's a condition placed, that must be complied with. Then if we go over to page 25, the Companies Act having to be complied with, I agree. We must make very clear that this bill, the administration that this bill is talking about, is not the administration that is referred to in the Companies Act. And I think that because this is, the word is the same, administration, and administration of estates, administration of companies, has become a big consumer buzzword. I think we must just be very careful, and it might be good just to make it very clear that this is not what this bill is referring to. Then in respect of withdrawing designation when being more narrowly defined, so it's not when it's not does not further government's industrial development objectives. No, if you're not furthering government's objectives, then you're no longer complying. It's as simple as that. But I do think we need to focus on consultation. There must be consultation. So, because what they were saying was, you know what, you might say that we're not furthering the objectives, but in fact we are, we might just be adding something or something like that. That will come out in consultation. But I think, you know, the SEZ is actually so special that we're creating separate legislation for this, to me, which indicates that this is kind of priority. It's not just a program anymore in the department. It's a priority. So if government is saying this is what we want to achieve with this, then that must be achieved. We can't come and I can just imagine what this committee will say to the DTI when they come 3 years from now and say, oh no, we not achieved the objectives of this bill because you know, the operators are not doing what the bill says they must be doing. This committee will be livid. We'll say, what are you doing? So no, I fully disagree with that. But consultation, I fully agree with. That we must do something about. The last row on that also deals with consultation. Well, I'm saying we need to consult. When you when the designation is withdrawn, there's practical implications. We need to make sure that we are fully on board with what is happening. If we go to page 26, there's a proposal that there should be some interim measures in respect of businesses in your SEZ. And what I'm saying is that might not be a bad proposal, because your withdrawal of designation of an IDZ, SEZ, sorry, will have implications for businesses. So it might be good to give that authority to the minister, so that it is not just, you know, 31 May you still SEZ, 1 June you no longer. But there is some, you know, there's some leeway for the minister, perhaps by notice in the Government Gazette, to say there will be a de-designation or withdrawal of the designation on 1 August. There are these measures to be taken. It could add value to the Act. The next row also deals with that, the same moratorium on further enterprises and so on. But what we must keep in mind is that it will not just suffice to say there must be a moratorium on further locators coming into the SEZ. What if this park is no longer falling within the objectives? Then it's not about not taking in further businesses, it's about you no longer being an SEZ. That is where the problem is. But I think that is something that can rather be done within this notice. The next row there deals with the operator being the same person as the licensee or the board or so on. And what I'm saying is it's a policy decision. DTI needs to explain to us if they want those four entities distinct, can they be one, whatever. But I think we need to, that will be part of clarifying the roles, so that we know exactly how it's going to work, and then we make provision for that. The next row also, it deals with exactly the same thing, where it should be the same person. If we page over, there is a proposed draft, but what I'm saying is that to me does not really answer the question. I think we will rather look at what DTI says is the case and what the committee agrees with and so on, and then we do a draft following from that decision. On page 27, the second last row there, again it deals with whether it should be four entities or if it can be shared functions. The last row, again it deals with the roles. Once we have eliminated the confusion on roles, then that will be fine, that will be sorted. Page 28, again, whether it is one person, four people, that can be sorted out when we do the roles. Then again, there's a draft proposed, and what I'm saying is, no, that I get where they're going, but it doesn't exactly answer the question. So when we have the roles sorted out, we will rather give some proposal between myself and the State Law Advisor and the department. Our drafting team will get together and give something to the committee. Page 29 is still the draft that is being proposed. So we go to page 30. On page 30, in the top there, this is my constitutional concern. What is proposed here is that the powers of the SEZ be limited in its founding memorandum of incorporation or in the bill itself. I have a concern that this might affect the right to trade. if we in a bill say to an entity that is applying, you may not trade in respect of the following, then we're limiting trade. The bill as it is says that someone will come and apply for a licensee permit, or for a license or for an operator permit. There will be requirements whether you fall within that category. That falling within that category, your business plan will be checked. Where you're going with this will be checked. And if your strategy, your memorandum of incorporation that is created afterwards, does not accord with your objectives anymore, your designation can be withdrawn. So there is already, by implication, a limit on anyone who wants to apply. I don't think we should put that in a bill, because I do think that we might have a constitutional challenge. In practice, there will be limitation, but I don't think we should put that in writing. Then the next row there talks about the sufficient money for an applicant must have access to sufficient money, readily available money. Now, what I'm concerned about is the way that the clause is worded does not provide for someone who, it says capital, must have capital. Now, capital, if you think about it, is actually money in the bank. So, or an asset, yeah, something that is out there that you can touch. It is not, Treasury has promised me in 3 years' time, I will get, you know, 20 billion rand for this project. So it is a concern. I think we need to change that wording. I'm proposing something like access to funding. You need to show where you're going to get your money from. If your money is already in the bank, then fine. You say, my money is in the bank. Or you say, my money, there's my MTF approval. You know, I've already consulted with Treasury. In principle, they've approved, or whatever. Especially for your municipalities, for your provincial departments, your national departments that want to apply. I think that's very important there. Then on the next page, page 31, now they want to do the same argument in respect of expertise, and here I say no, here I differ. It is not access to expertise that should be in the bill, because if the applicant comes and says, I've got the necessary expertise, what the applicant will say is, I have the following operating manager in mind. This operator comes from Shishin IDZ, and he or she has 10 years experience in that field, and therefore will be, you know, making a success of this designated area. So it is implied that your expertise will be access to expertise, rather than that the municipality has that expertise. I think the bill is sufficiently providing for that. Then they would also like a clause in the third row on that page 31 that the licensee shall not be liable to the operator if the zone is deproclaimed or the license is suspended or terminated. I think, honestly, that the municipalities, the PPPs, the departments should get good lawyers on board and make sure that that is in their agreement with the operator. That for me is a legal risk, and as a lawyer, I cannot see any lawyer worth his or her salt that will not put something like that into an agreement. There is absolutely no need for us to put that in the bill. That is highly operational. It's something that fits in an agreement, not in a bill. The next page, page 32, this deals with, the first one deals with the roles. So I'm not going to say much on that. It is, if the roles are classified, I think that will be sorted. The next is that the section must also, this specific clause, clause 34, it gives a list of things that must be done by the operator. Now, the recommendation is that it must allow the operator to enter into leases with businesses locating in the zone. So what I'm saying is, because we've got must in the list, you know, if an operator, and I think it would be legally very risky not to enter into an agreement with a locator or an enterprise, but I think it goes without saying that he may do that. It is something that is not a must, and that is why it's not in this list. However, if the committee feels, look, let's make it clear that this is something that must be done. We want agreements in place. It will resolve disputes in future, or even, you know, get rid of disputes. Then I would advise that we don't put in leases. Lease has a very specific meaning. It relates to renting. Now, if the licensee sells property to a locator, how on earth is the operator going to lease that property to the enterprise? It's impossible. So I would rather suggest, instead of lease, we say agreement. Agreement is wide. It can be any type of agreement. The next row then, what will become of the zone if the licensee is not the operator and the permit of the operator is withdrawn? Again, this comes back to my concern of consultation. If we've done consultation beforehand, this will be quite clear. There will not be a problem. The licensee will know to appoint an interim operator, etc. Then if we go to page 33, again, this speaks to relationships and roles. Now, it says, what will happen to the operator if he has invested in the zone and his permit is withdrawn? And what I'm saying is, well, you will have a contract with the licensee, first of all, and you will revert to your contract. Your contract will say what will happen. And the operator might actually find himself on the other side, or the shoe on the other foot, actually, if the operator's permit is withdrawn because of a failure to perform. But then the licensee might say, I'm now taking you on for the damages that I'm suffering. But that is something that is arranged in agreement between the parties, and it's not something for a bill. So the reason that is read is simply because it speaks to the roles. So I don't think there's something that must be amended there, but it still speaks to the roles and the relationships, which I think must be made a lot clearer. The next row there speaks about administrative fines for lesser infractions. And what I'm saying is, I think I agree with this. It is, in the end, a policy decision. It's not a legal decision. But from a practical point of view, as a lawyer, if I'm requested to address someone on a failure and my only option is withdrawal of the permit, it ties my hands. If I can recommend to the minister, let's make an administrative fine, or let's do, some other form of penalty, a warning. Then I'm of the opinion that will achieve the objective, then I would rather do that than say withdraw. So it might be good just to simply indicate in the bill that there are other remedies that the minister can do, and perhaps we can say, look, at this point in time, he might not have thought about it, but maybe then he can, by regulation, say, you know, there are administrative penalties that may be imposed, and they may consist of the following. Just to make it a little bit easier on the minister also to maneuver. The next line deals with the roles, and what I'm saying there is also, it would be good just to provide for transitional arrangements. If you're going to withdraw or suspend, we need to make provision that the minister can, maybe by a directive that is published, simply say the following measures will apply until designation is withdrawn. It creates certainty. It avoids the minister being taken to court because he's withdrawing the designation and he hasn't done this or that or the following. If it's in a directive, it's quite clear what the process will be. The last row there says that can the minister, or is it wise to allow the minister to suspend or withdraw a permit for a small contravention of the custom rules if SART is not even considering withdrawing their approval or permit? Now, I don't think that the Commissioner of SART will notify the Department of Trade and Industry of a tiny infraction. You were one day late. I really don't see the Commissioner doing that. But we can, maybe, for clarity and making sure that it's not vague at all, simply say to substitute the word for notify of the word request. So if the Commissioner actually requests that, it's not just a notification, it's a request, then that may be the case. If we then go over to the next page, 34, consultation. Absolutely. You know, should you not have the consent of the licensee when there's a transfer? Absolutely. You need. Because these parties are working on the same project. You need, not if not consent, you at least have to have taken the views on board. So absolutely consultation. Consultation is extremely important. I think we must make clear provision in this bill for it. Over on page 35, in fact there, when it comes to the enterprises locating within a zone, I would recommend that it be in consultation with the licensee and operator. Because it's that operator and that licensee that has the responsibility to make that zone work. And they will report to the minister on the success of that zone. If they can turn around and say to the minister, but you've put a business here that we didn't want, that wasn't in accordance with our plan, our strategy, and look now, this business is causing us to fail, you have a problem. So I would recommend that that is actually in consultation. The next row on page 35 deals with automatic absorption. Now, on this for me relates to the interim measures, and this was the fourth issue where I'm saying we must be very clear. What is it that the DGR wants with current IDZs to happen? How should they be absorbed in the current system? Should it be automatic? Should it be something where they must comply with something? What will happen if an IDZ already has enterprises within its borders that don't qualify? What will happen to that enterprise? How will that affect it? So I think the DGR needs to be very clear to this committee on what is envisaged for this. And it's not a difficult exercise because the DGR already knows which of the four or five that have been approved so far qualifies and what are the problems with the others. And I think that can clearly be addressed so that we make sure that that is clear. There, the last paragraph in the red, I think we need to just make clear in the bill that it's not just that the designation is automatic. There's also a classification, because now we're providing for more than one type of SEZ. I think the minister must also just indicate what the classification is. If they're all going to be the same, we can perhaps in the bill say that they will be a what SEZ. Page 36. This again still deals with the interim provision, whether it should be automatic. Automatic will be the easiest, but we need to understand what the DGI is envisaging for the current IDZ. The last row on that page 36 deals again with the roles of the parties, the relationship, so I'm not going to focus on that. I've already addressed the committee on that. The next page, page 37, transfer, that again deals with the interim, whether this transfer should be automatic, should it there be this five-year period wherein the IDZs can be made to comply with the SEZ requirements. How is that going to be done? DGI should explain that to the committee, and then we will make sure that that is what the bill reflects. The next row there deals with the existing IDZ regulations. Now, I need to first of all explain to this committee that the IDZ regulations aren't regulations as this committee knows the word regulations. They are issued in terms of the Manufacturing Development Act under, I think it's Section 10, dealing with incentive creation and so on. We will find that when you look at the regulations, it actually at the beginning has a definition saying regulations in this notice means these terms under here. So it is in fact a notice, it's not regulations, but if something is to be repealed, I would recommend that it is done under the Manufacturing Development Act. If DGI wants to repeal it in this bill, it can be included. But DGI needs to decide how they would like to do that. It is not something that I don't see it as a big problem, because it's not like it is regulations. It is a notice that's there that was in respect of an incentive program, which is now we have a bill. It's a total different ball game. But I think what we also need to just look at as in respect of your interim regulations, because they also speak here about the enterprises. This bill doesn't currently provide for enterprises to be automatically approved or have to apply to be approved. So our interim measures just need to provide for enterprises as well. Then in respect of the guidelines, I tend to agree that I don't think that the bill is necessarily the correct place for guidelines to be, especially if those guidelines aren't binding on the minister. That means these guidelines are simply operation manuals. that will be there anyway, whether the bill provides for them or not. So, in fact, you know, the fact that it says it's not binding on the minister almost has a negative connotation. You almost wonder, why is this not binding on the minister? But it's simply because they're guidelines. They're not cast in stone. But I don't think it's wrong to have them in the bill necessarily, or you know, legally speaking, wrong. But I don't see the need for them in the bill. Then the last page, and there we have the regulations, and the fact that the regulations, the discretion given, is too wide. I've gone through, I've again read the affordable medicines case, and no, the court said, if your bill provides a framework, then that is the framework within the minister will do the regulations. And even the way that it's worded, it is for the implementation of this bill, or of this act. It is for where this act actually provides for regulations to be done. So it's not unfettered. I think the regulations clause is 100% sufficient. And that is me. Thank you very much for listening to me for so long.
Yes, indeed, Advocate van der Merwe, your speed has gone up again, and we can certainly put you into the the legal kailami. you covered the aspects you wish to cover, and I think you did it effectively and succinctly. Now, of course, that doesn't mean Advocate van der Merwe is released forever. The sense is she will remain with us until this bill has been taken, passed out of this committee and moved on. So I look at the situation now where we've had both comments. And I say this because, again, the SEZ is an important piece of legislation, and we're sitting with two core members of the committee here, and an alternate member from the DA who will not be spending that amount of time with this piece of legislation. And I think that, you know, we will undermine the process of robust oversight. You know, it's most unfortunate, DDG Chipfuba, that you've had a team down here for this length of time. We thought we would deal with it last night, but I don't think you would have wanted members dealing with it in their exhausted state. We've seen where that leads. So, I do apologize to you, because I think that expenditure, time is expenditure, and you have been down here. But I would hope you have benefited from the passage of the BBBEE as well, that process. But I do want to thank all of the DTI team for being present. Pardon?
Can we comment?
No, you may. But what we're not going to do is go into a huge engagement. And the reason for that is what I have said right at the beginning. We want a fairly full committee, you see. So all I will allow at this moment of about 5 minutes or so are simply comments, general comments, not specific comments. But I also want to thank you, Advocate van der Merwe, for that sterling work that you've undertaken and very comprehensive analysis. Thank you. Right, over to you, members, for a comment, generally. Honourable van der Merwe.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think as we are here, those of us that are here, we have to say a few things. And the first one is it became absolutely clear through the public hearings, as well as the comprehensive analysis of the public hearing comments by the Advocate van der Merwe, that there's a lot of work that still needs being done on this bill. I think we have to ask for a couple of things. I think we have to ask the department that they must respond to the three or four major issues that the advocate raised, because they were certainly on our list to raise. The composition of the board has worried us for some time. The question of the roles of the various entities and licensee and operator and so on is of quite grave concern. I also think the consultation issue is important, and then the one-stop shop thing was another thing that, well, there were a lot of niggly little things, but the one-stop shop thing has to also be taken into account. I think because, I'm saying the one-stop shop thing because this is, as was pointed out, a special zone. It's special. It has to therefore act efficiently, and it has to be different in the way that it operates. And I don't think we have sufficiently incorporated that in some of the pieces of this legislation. We have to ensure that decisions are made quickly, for example. I'm not sure that a board of that nature meeting four times a year and with a minister's responsibility is going to act quickly. I think the transition arrangements, for example, are inadequate, because in the beginning there's going to be a flood of applications, a flood, because all the IDZs are going to try and get upgraded, and all the new ones are going to happen as well. I think we need to really focus on interim or transition measures as well. So what my proposal is if we ask the department to go back and consider everything that's been said and come with a really thorough a set of proposals on how to accommodate some of those things. That's really all I want to say, Chair.
Are there any other comments, please? I think the, so what we're looking at here, there were some core issues and some very serious core issues. And rather than waste time yourself trying to deal with every single thing, which we will deal with, let's focus on the essentials, the core first. When we've addressed the core, let us then look at the rest. I think that's the first thing. And I'm sure this also gives you the opportunity to engage with colleagues, both from Parliament in the legal sphere and within your own department. And I would add that a smaller issue, you know, there are reference to guidelines all over in the bill. And we've already heard that, you know, these are really by way of notices. And I think that it'll be important to ensure that we retain the robust essence of this bill. What does it want to achieve? So I do want to give you that opportunity, and I think, honourable members, that what we'll do is, if you've got your programs here, if you don't, I will indicate to you that the secretary and myself were looking at next Wednesday, when we are scheduled to meet. You know, we are scheduled to meet. However, not at 9 o'clock. Now, this is an important issue. 8 a.m. And I'd really appreciate it, Honourable Schaefer, if you would communicate this to your colleagues. Because it's seldom that we sit at 8 a.m. Wednesday. It is on the schedule, but I mean, we want to make sure that people are here. And at the same time, I would request the department to make available to us on Tuesday, you know, afternoon if possible, because I think members want to get sight of it before they get into the meeting. That's my understanding of things. And I would certainly suggest, Mr. Hermans, that this, for once, just move straight through to you, a copy to me, is okay, and immediately sent electronically to all members, so they've all had a look at it. That's the first thing. The other thing is the how will the rest of that program work? You'll see that was the 29th, and in fact, as I see it there, that was the only meeting of this committee due to the budget programming. the following week, just to keep in mind, you're looking at the 4th, and you will once again return on those deliberations. Okay, but then we go back to the 10 o'clock, Tuesdays to always 10 o'clock, or most of the time, and then Wednesdays at 9. But I don't want to push this bill beyond its boundaries. I want to ensure that there's space. You know, we do have time on our side, and I'm looking at Honourable Khadebi, that there's a need for us to ensure, even if it comes to that week of the 4th, you know, what kind of space you'll give the DTI and our own legal people. And I think you'll take care of that particular week. I want to thank all members, the core members who stayed. I want to thank you, Honourable Schaefer, for being here with us this morning. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.